Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Melissa Kozer of 10 to 1, and we're going to be talking about N.K. Jemisin's The Fifth Season, which won the 2016 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Melissa, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yes, this is you are my first full married couple that I've covered on the show, so that's good.
Yeah, my husband was on, I think, in December.
Yeah.
And he did the Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Yes.
With you.
Yeah, so since he talked about your podcast, we don't have to reiterate that kind of stuff, but let's talk about some of your history as a fan of science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah, well, like any good sci-fi fantasy fan, I started with Chronicles of Narnia, grew up with those books, and those books were falling apart by the time I got to them, just from my brothers, my older siblings rereading them, you know, because they're amazing. And of course, we didn't help them along any because we read them so much. And then somewhere between the ages of 12 and 14, I encountered the Wheel of Time series. And that like was a really mind-blowing experience. Like it just open my eyes that there's whole worlds out there that can really be expanded and built upon and stuff. And I'm not saying Wheel of Time is great literature, but I reread it as an adult and I thought, yeah, it still holds up. I also really got into Star Wars as a teenager, the extended universe. And then recently, as an adult, some of my favorite stuff is Avatar The Last Airbender and superheroes. I'm a little bit behind everybody else, as you can see. I kind of get into the nerdy stuff much later than most kids, but I'm getting there.
Yeah, yeah. And that gives it time to
see what's kinda the cream and what's the crap.
Exactly, right? Like Ben DiBono says on the Sci-Fi Christian, right?
Exactly.
What is that law?
Sturgeon's Law.
Sturgeon's Law, yes. 90% of everything is crap, so that's cool. Anything else you want to mention about yourself?
Well, I'm a mom of two, soon to be three kids.
Nice.
The next one is due in August.
Yeah. That was our one ticking clock on getting an episode in, right? You're like, let's get this done before August. Cool. All right. Well, how about this book? Why this book in particular?
Well, my husband happened to mention that you had been looking for volunteers to read through the Hugo winners. And so I looked at the synopses for the unclaimed books on your list and decided this one sounded the most interesting and most up my alley. And so I contacted you and here we are.
Perfect. So you mentioned that did you get to read it more than one time or just the one time?
Yeah. So originally I think you'd mentioned we were going to do this show back in like beginning of March or even February possibly. And so I read through it pretty quickly within a week or so in January and was not really interested in ever reading it again. But I was doing a podcast on it and then so I was like, well, I guess I'll have to at least go back and look at a few things. And then months went by and we weren't able to do this episode for whatever, you know, something with on your end, something on my end. And so finally you said, okay, we're going to do it in June. And I was like, I guess I really should reread it. And again, spent about a week just kind of taking it apart this time. And it was a lot different on the second read through.
Cool. I'll be interested to hear what your impressions are.
Yeah.
So if you had to give a quick kind of elevator pitch or non-spoiler-ish synopsis of this book, how would you do that?
All right. Well, the story follows three female characters with superhuman abilities in a world and age where their powers are feared and generally despised. Each one seeks to create a meaningful existence for himself in spite of her circumstances and barriers. And it's got a lot of themes that it tackles, like expectations versus reality, racism, what's it mean to be human, what's it mean to be civilized, do your birth or circumstances define you, and quality of life. So it's actually a pretty deep book.
Yeah. So if you were going to recommend this novel to anybody, if, you know, kind of, is there anything else that you can compare it to, any other things that it's similar to, or like fans of other properties that might enjoy this.
Yeah. I'd say if you like post-apocalyptic fiction, this is probably something you're going to enjoy. That's the main thing right there. I've really been getting into post-apocalyptic stuff a lot more lately. It worked for me on that level. It's a very intelligent book. It doesn't dumb things down for you. You got to figure it out as you go.
Right.
If you like stories that really involve you emotionally, you might enjoy this. Mm-hmm. Or you might not, right, for that exact reason.
It could go either way.
Yeah. But it will involve you. That's definitely for sure. If you like stories where humans have special abilities, or stories about lost and ancient civilizations, both of those are really big hitters for me.
Yeah.
I love reading about, there used to be this grandiose, city, and now there's nothing, and there's just little remnants that you can kind of pick apart and try to figure out what happened. So yeah. that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. It is not your average happily ever after story. So if you're looking for something different, you right. might like this. Mm-hmm. I will say this is definitely adult fiction.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't recommend it for teens because it's got a lot of dark and shocking content.
Agreed. Yeah. It reminds me to some extent a little bit of like X-Men, even though I'm not terribly well versed in X-Men outside the movies, just because mm-hmm. you have people with abilities who are kind of feared and despised and hunted mm-hmm. for them. But yeah, it's post-apocalyptic. It's also kind of moving into general thoughts about it. It's kind of genre bending because it seems like magical powers. And so that
right.
that moves it into kind of the fantasy side. But then there's mysteries about, post-apocalyptic is a science fiction genre, and there's evidence right. of previous, fallen civilizations. And there seems to be some very advanced technology as well. So I'm curious in future books, if we're going to find out that this is actually Earth. That's the other question, because it doesn't actually come out and say it.
I think that's what we're led to believe, at least through this first book. And that's one of the marks of post-apocalyptic, is it feels like, yes, what we're seeing now is very different from Earth right now. Mm-hmm. But you're supposed to feel like, yeah, with one or two steps, wrong steps in the wrong direction, then we could definitely end up like this. So, and I got that vibe from this book.
So let's go ahead and kind of move into our non-spoiler discussion. We can kind of do that briefly before we get into spoilers. But just kind of, like I said, general impressions of the book. It sounded like on the first read, you weren't an enormous fan of the book.
Yeah, well, I've kind of alluded to it a little bit in recommendations, in that it's got a lot of dark content, not your average happily ever after, and it gets you emotionally involved. So three little clues right there that it made me cry several times. Mm. And I mean, I'm not against a book making me cry, but there were some incredibly sad moments.
Yes.
I can't really elaborate further without spoiling.
Gotcha.
But I guess one of them is it happens like in the first 10 pages. So I don't mm-hmm. know that it's that big of a spoiler.
Sure.
And it talks on the back of the book about it, too. Mm-hmm. But it starts off with the death of this mother's child.
Right.
And the way it is said in the book is just so sudden, so startling. It really hits hard.
Yes.
And my children are the age of the child that dies.
Oh, yeah.
And so, 10 pages into the book, I was like, oh boy, I don't know if I can keep doing this.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily get much happier mm-hmm. throughout the rest of the book. So, I mean, there's bright moments and you see good things happen, but it's definitely very sobering stuff.
Agreed.
So that doesn't make it, it's not necessarily an experience that you definitely want to rush out and relive all over again.
Right.
But the second time around, I was familiar with the story. I knew what was going to happen, so I could be a little more emotionally detached and look look more at the at what exactly is going on a deeper level and the brilliance of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, on a first-time read, I definitely resonate with some of what you said about the darker tones. I mean, like you said, there's moments of levity in it, but for the most part, the tone is just pretty dark. It's some of the stuff that happens mm-hmm. is truly, truly horrifying. But that being said, I really, really enjoyed this one. And it was one that I kept wanting to go through. And part of that was the narrative structure.
Okay.
Because you have the three parallel stories going on. And mm-hmm. one of them is in second person, which was an interesting thing. It was an interesting choice where instead of saying, you know, this character does this thing, it said, you do this thing.
Yeah, that's true.
It kind of pulls you into the book mm-hmm. that way. And but then shifting between the other stories, you're like, wow, okay, we're getting kind of slices of what this world is like. And mm-hmm. some of it's really rough. But it was one where as soon as I finished the book, I put a hold request on the audiobook for the Obelisk Gate, for the next book in the series. Just because that's another thing to let people know about is this is clearly part one of
You cannot
story.
Stop.
Yeah.
Yeah. You cannot stop with book one. We're just going to put that out right now.
Yeah.
some trilogies, you can kind of, there's a little bit of a breaking point between book one and book two. Mm-hmm. That's not the case with this one.
Right. I mean, it's not a complete cliffhanger. I feel like it finishes telling the story it was telling, but not telling the story of this world completely. So
you are definitely left feeling incomplete.
Yes. Yeah. But I feel like it was a logical place to stop because it brings it full circle from the prologue to the very end. It's good bookends. So, how about we just go ahead and get right into spoilers?
Okay.
So why don't you can go ahead and talk about what you wanted to talk about.
All right. Well, I think the most major spoiler is that the three women I referenced earlier are the same person. So you've right. got Damaya, and that's the woman when she's a little girl, mm-hmm. and she's first found out as an origin. Origins are people that have the ability to move the earth around. They're sort of earthbenders, mm-hmm. and then there's Cyanite, and that's her after she's had training as an origin, and she's gone to a special school. And then there's Essen years later, who she's the one that you first meet, and her child dies mm-hmm. right at the beginning of the book.
Right.
So the fact that they're all different names, for a while I really thought that these were very separate people mm-hmm. and that they were going to meet up at some point later in the book. And I'm a little embarrassed to admit that it wasn't till three quarters, maybe a little farther along through the book, it finally dawned on me that they're the same woman.
Right.
And it's when Damaya starts to explore through the unused portion of the Fulcrum
right.
school. And just somehow, it wasn't anything in the chapter. I mean, at the end, it does say that she chooses the name Cyanite, but it was right at the beginning of that chapter, mm-hmm. And there wasn't anything specific that tipped me off. But it was just all of a sudden, it was like, "Oh, of course,
yeah.
That's who this is." And then from there, I figured out pretty quickly that Alabaster is the guy at the beginning of the book who destroys the world.
Right, and that's what I was talking about at the bookends, where it starts with Alabaster breaking the earth and ends with him saying, Cyanite, I need you to finish the job. Or, sorry, Essen, I know. Yeah.
Someone's bitter.
Yeah, right. With good reason, and I definitely want to get into talk about that, but I wanted to mention, I think I had picked up fairly early on, I may have heard a spoiler someplace that it was told in different time frames. And so,
okay.
So at first I was thinking, okay, these are going to be hundreds of years apart. But then I thought, you know, Damaya going to the school probably, or like Damaya gets a guardian and, mm-hmm. and I thought, okay, well, Cyanite kind of is just going out on her own. And it occurred to me that they might be the same person, but I was mm-hmm. slow in picking up that they might all three be the same person.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Yeah, and it's the book's very cleverly told in that if there's any, I mean, second time through, you pick up on a few little references. And I love that. I love that in books when, yeah, you know, now you know what to look for. You can see the little clues. But it's not very, very obvious, not apparent.
Sure.
And so I do really love books that will hint for those who already know, mm-hmm, or who are smart enough to pick it up. But otherwise conceal the truth until the big, big shocking moment.
Right. Yeah. So like I alluded to earlier, the kind of genre bending here, I'm not sure if the Origin's powers is magical or if it's somehow, you know, Clark's Law kind of just sufficiently advanced technology or something. Or if right, it's like X-Men, where these people have evolved this ability.
Right. It sounded like, because I was really looking for clues through that, to that, the second time around. And it sounds like it's a little bit of both. Yeah. It looks like humans had perhaps the ability, the gene in them to mutate. And all it took was a little nudge in the right direction from, at some point it says something about some alchemical reactions or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I think like people started messing with things that maybe they should have left alone. And then that tipped them over the edge.
Yeah. There's also the notion that the Guardians have some kind of augmentation that allows them to control the Origins and turn their powers back on, yes, on themselves, which is horrifying. And maybe this is the time to talk about the Fulcrum, because when we first learn about the Fulcrum, this is a school. We're going to help you control your special ability. But on the other hand, she's not leading you down a primrose path to this is all going to be good and happy and fun, because the first thing, mm-hmm, that her guardian does is test that she can basically not try and destroy something,
right,
as a response, mm-hmm, to pain, and he breaks her hand. And that's,
I know,
like, this is a little girl. What,
another
are you doing?
Shocking moment. Yeah. I know. Yeah. So the Guardians are, I think, one of the most fascinating things that are left mostly unexplored, mm-hmm, through this book, because I had so many questions raised about them and I really wanted to know. It does mention at some point that they have implants,
yeah,
put in that allows them to negate Origini. And they're actually the children of Origines themselves. Mm. So I kind of want to know, like, where are they trained? What are their rules and what goes into the making of a guardian? And then the Fulcrum, you find out later that it was Origins themselves who started it. You know, the way it's presented, it seems like kind of a domination thing to put these people with magical powers, put them in their place so that we can show dominance over them and they're not going to gain the upper hand. But it ends up, actually, it was the Origins who started the Fulcrum in the first place so, right, that the world would be less afraid of them. And to show, to try and, they put a chain around their own necks in order to hopefully try and help people not be afraid of them. But centuries later, it doesn't appear to really have worked too much.
No, not so much.
I mean, they're allowed to move around. I mean, the wild, untrained ones, the rogas, as they're called, mm-hmm, I mean, mobs will go out and kill them at first chance they get. Right. And there's a scene right there at the beginning when Essen is trying to leave her home village and people discover, oh, she's orogenic. They try to kill her, mm-hmm, even though she's leaving and just wants to be away from their town. They're still going to try and kill her because better a dead one than a live one. And right, so it doesn't appear that having training really has made them less feared or appreciated.
Yeah, I kind of get the impression it's just sort of the people are ignorant of them and so they fear them. Where, mm-hmm, whereas then in the Fulcrum and in the larger cities, people at least appreciate their capabilities. They still fear them and mistrust them. But they're not quite as ignorant, right? They know, they use them. I mean, there's no other way to say it.
Yeah, there are more tools than people. That was actually one of the themes that I picked up on was racism, is that, you know, people fear what they don't understand. And it's the same with stone eaters, too. The origins fear the stone eaters because they don't understand them. Nobody knows what those are like. And it's kind of interesting how just humanity hasn't really changed in the far future. You know, if we can't control it, then we fear it. And yet we do still try to control it. And if we can't control it, then we kill it.
Yeah. Speaking of control, probably the most horrifying thing in the novel, and it's saying something because there's quite a few things, is the node maintainer.
Yeah.
Just, it just made me shiver because you had a young boy, the one that we saw, right? And I guess we're to assume that this is all the node maintainers, where they've been stripped entirely of their humanity.
And they're Alabaster's children.
Yeah. And just turned into something that is technically alive and suffering, but doesn't have, you know, the higher brain function or anything like that. It just reacts on instinct to quell microshakes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. All free will's taken away. They're just kept in a permanent coma. It's awful.
Yeah. So Alabaster is an interesting character. At first, I have to admit that I thought, after we learned of Cyanide and Alabaster's child, his name was Corundum. Mm-hmm. I thought that we were gonna, at the end, it was gonna turn out that it was him that broke everything because he seemed to be very powerful.
I thought we'd get to follow his story in book two.
Yeah, and not so much. But yeah, Alabaster, that's another horrifying thing, right? The forced breeding program. We do find out that Alabaster is gay, right? He has no interest in having any kind of relations with Cyanide, but they're both basically required to mate, and there's no other way to put it because that's what
they have to do, what they're told to do.
Yeah. Yeah. They have to produce a child. Mm-hmm. Who will probably be terribly mistreated, and that's not what
I know. And Alabaster mentions this at one point that there's not really any good outcome. The best that they can hope for is that he'll get to go to school in the Fulcrum, and that's still, you know, he'll grow up without love. He'll grow up just being told that he's basically like dynamite, useful in some. Situations, you know, you can use dynamite to help clear out areas and stuff, but highly volatile, tread with care, and you know, don't use it unless you have to. So, and that's an awful way to view yourself or have your, and especially your child, you know, that you don't get to raise in a loving environment. You don't get to teach them anything. You're depending on other people to teach them morals, teach them about themselves, teach them everything, their history. Yeah. And that was another thing is, there's secret histories, that aren't really being taught, as a general rule. The Alabaster has discovered, you know, these other tablets of stone lore that most people don't know about.
Mm. So we've gotten this far in the book and haven't even discussed the whole notion of the fifth season.
I know.
What the title is based on. So do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So that was, I thought, an interesting way to think about it. So the first four seasons, of course, are spring, summer, winter, summer, fall, winter. And then the fifth season is death. And, boy, what a way to think of it as just the hardened, cold view that people have had to adopt towards life and reality that, okay, this is just a time of death and, we're going to try and get through it somehow, but we probably won't. And just how humanity's really had to adapt. These people, they have to live in a constant state of disaster preparedness.
Right.
we prepare for a hurricane season, and it's not that big of a deal. We go out and we buy some canned foods, buy some batteries, candle, you know, some mm-hmm. things like that, so that if the power is gone for a few days, you know, even a week, it's not that big of a deal. As we get advance warning that hurricanes are coming, elsewhere too. I mean, just like tornadoes or floods, especially here in America. I've lived overseas in Puerto Rico and Honduras, and things aren't as good there. But mm-hmm. even still, in a third world country, you still get advance warning on the news that, okay, something's coming up. Even if it's blowing up a day in advance, you've still got a day to prepare. These people are living for something could happen right this instant.
Right. And last for 6 months or 5 years.
Or 20 years.
Yeah.
And that's a really, I'm not even sure what the right word is for that, just to live like that, knowing that you could die at any second. We all know that we're mortal, but you know, you don't think that you're going to die at any second in your own, sitting in your own house, you know?
Right.
And so it kind of makes you understand a little bit why humanity has become so much harder and colder. You know, there at the beginning, it talks about the communities, the comms, and how if you're not part of a comm, then, you know, there's no way really that you're going to last through a fifth season, much less mm-hmm. most of the other seasons. And how the comms help everybody work together. But even then, you see how as a fifth season is starting, there in Tiramo, everybody just kind of ends up turning on each other.
Right.
And so, you know, humanity still isn't really pulling together very much because I guess they've just gotten more hardened to death, I think.
Yeah.
And it's just really sad, though, because it's in times of crisis that what really helps is loving and sharing and pulling together, that we're all in this together. Let's mm-hmm. try and make it work instead of every man for himself.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's kind of doubly ironic too, that in the seasons, the abilities of the origins would be really handy, right? To try mm-hmm. to avoid, like if it was volcanic activity or an earthquake or something that was causing a lot of the damage, then having one of these folks around would be great. And maybe if you treated them well, you know, they would actually help.
Yep. So the fulcrum is one of those things where it seems to be a bit of a necessary evil, but mm-hmm. like maybe there should be the starting point, and then we evolve from there somehow. I don't have a perfect solution for how they would do that, but like they do need to learn control, because you know there are horrific consequences if they don't. They can end up killing those around them just in trying to stop an earthquake or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's why people fear them is because of the danger to themselves and that there's nothing that they could do. So you do need a school where people can be taught control, but you need to teach them that they're humans too, and that they're people, and that we're working together for the greater good instead of you are serving us for the greater good.
Right. And the school too is limiting them. It's not mm-hmm. not teaching them to use their abilities to the fullest. It's teaching them to use them in the ways that are useful to the comms. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that Alabaster, you know, rejects, that says, you know, hey, they've shackled us, right?
Uh-huh. He says later that there's stuff that he learned later when he went beyond the Fulcrum's teachings. And even Cyanite, too, like when she starts drawing on the power of the obelisks. You know, she's doing stuff she hasn't been trained to do. Mm-hmm. So it's again, you need the school for the, I don't know. I would say it's kind of like life today. You need school so that you learn, discipline and rigor and sticking to your work and things like that. But you don't go to school so that you can learn love and empathy for other humans. Mm-hmm. You know, you learn that from your parents and from close friends and family. And so, but all of the origins are cut off from family.
Yeah.
Friendship isn't really encouraged. And so you've got these people growing up with no real emotional attachment mm-hmm. to the world around them.
Well, kind of on that idea, the no emotional attachment, you move into the Stone Eaters, which I'm very curious if we're going to learn more about them in future books. Are these just origins who have gone to the, you know, the limit of their abilities and turned into Earth almost? I don't know. So I'll be curious.
Yeah, I was really, really looking for clues about the Stone Eaters, and there's not much about them. Mm-hmm. It again, there's kind of legends, a few stories, and I like the little quotes at the end of each chapter.
Oh, from
that's
the
always
lore?
Interesting too. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. There was one on page 296 where it says, "The Stone Eater is folly made flesh. Learn the lesson of its creation and beware its gifts." So that one, that I love it. It's so vague, and yet it right. hints at so much.
Yeah, it makes me think of like they're androids or something that were created by humans.
Almost. Yeah. Except and you could definitely think that, except Hoa seems so different.
Yes.
From all the other Stone Eaters. You get this whole stereotype, and then Hoa ends up, maybe he's the next step in their evolution. Who knows? Because he wants Essen to like him, mm-hmm. and he has done everything he can to look and appear normal, hiding the things that otherwise he couldn't hide right in front of her. Mm-hmm. He's very careful not to eat around her so that she won't see his teeth. He didn't want to use his powers, except it ended up that it was a life or death situation.
Right.
And so, and that actually ended up being one of my favorite moments is when they're, Essen and Hoa are at that little hut.
Roadhouse.
The roadhouse, and that Kirkusa creature comes up and it's going to attack them. And Hoa kills it by turning it into stone, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's really shocking. And you see how Essen is horrified. And then Hoa looks down and he looks miserable. He didn't want her to see that. Mm-hmm. And she feels sympathy for him. It's a moment where she sees, I think she kind of gets a chance to see how others see her mm-hmm. as something terrifying with powers that they don't understand. Mm-hmm. And yet she doesn't turn into what everybody else is. She instead makes her feel sympathy for him. And she just sees a little boy that she right. wants to help. And so that actually ended up being one of my favorite moments in the book. A little bright spark.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amidst all the darkness.
Yeah. I've mentioned on other podcasts before that I'm not a huge fan of fantasy world building, but
okay.
But somehow the world building in this one just seems effortless to me. It just kind of comes with the, mm-hmm. with the setting. And since it's through character viewpoint, it all just completely worked for me. Mm-hmm. And there's the other effortless thing here is representation, right? There's no question. You mentioned that, you know, there's obviously allusions to racism in the book, because people fear the origins, but in terms of, the humans in the book, you know, they're all different colors, and there doesn't seem to be mm-hmm. any judgment of each other based on how they look, which I thought was cool.
Yeah. Talking about world building and stuff. I agree. It was very, very effortless. One of the things that when I first read the book, I thought was going to be a really big turnoff was the way it's told, mostly in first person, sometimes in second person. Right. I guess a lot of it is third person, but it's still the present tense mm-hmm. point of view. And I've read books where that is, most books I've read actually, where they try to do that, it's just awful. I hate it.
Yeah.
And I prefer the omniscient narrator feel. But in this one, it works so well. Mm-hmm. It feels like you're listening to people's thoughts, which yes. makes the story more engrossing. But yet you're still allowed to be an observer. And you find out terms and events and powers through context. So then that makes it more fun to try and figure out what's going on according to what's been said in previous chapters. And I like books like that where they'll say something and you're like, wait a second. And you'll flip back a few pages and, now that makes sense in light of what I just read.
Any other things you want to mention about this book? We haven't been talking all that long, it seems.
Yeah, I actually still have a fair bit of notes.
Okay, go ahead.
So I mentioned about the different themes and I wanted to talk through some of these because, the first time through, it was all about the story. But the second time through, like, so much jumped out at me. And you talked about the world building is effortless. I think the themes woven in are done so effortlessly, too, just through the story. And it's not preachy. It's not trying to get across this is wrong or right or this is how we should change the ills in our society. It holds up a mirror.
Right.
And it was really interesting.
Yeah. Even just kind of by showing the counterexample that tells you this is not how things should be, right? We shouldn't be judging people on how they look or of, you know, of who they are. There's even, I guess there's a trans character here as well. And there's really no judgment there either. Which
we'll get to that later. That was an interesting point in the book. Mm-hmm. But one of the themes, I guess we'll just talk about it now.
Yeah.
When they get to the trans character, I don't, you know, if you want to have, for me, a book that's all about, you know, breaking societal norms or whatever and all the, and it's, people are just doing whatever, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But then when it got into the really, raw and gritty details of the love triangle between Sinai and Enon and Alabaster, I was like, whoa there.
Yeah, that's not for kids.
That was the moment when I was like, if I was not doing this for a podcast, I think I'd be done. Because I don't mind, you know, if you want to have that in the book, but I don't need the details.
Right.
And so, those are on pages 371 and 372. Anybody listening this far that wants to skip them, that's if you're like me and you don't need all the details on that.
Yeah.
But on the second time around, I did definitely skip it, but I kind of saw the point of it was that Alabaster and Cyanite just want to feel loved and human, you know. They haven't really had love, certainly not with each other, and you know, through their forced breeding. And so finally they have this chance at peace and happiness, and eventually, of course, that's going to be taken away from them too, because there's just nothing happy that happens in this book.
True enough.
In fact, at one point it says in the book, on page 361, I made a note of this. It says the time of happiness is unimportant to the story. It's Hoa speaking to you. And it's like, yeah, you had some happy times and just know that they were there. But we're not going to get into the details of it, really, because that's not important.
Yeah.
It's pain that shapes us. It's like, thanks a lot. I think we've had enough pain. I think we can have a little more happiness.
Right.
Anyway, so some of the themes that really stuck out, though, one of them was expectations versus reality. Mm-hmm. So Damaya thinks as a child, if she does what she's supposed to, then no unexpected things will happen. Of course, later in Alia, Cyanite does what she's asked to do, what she's expected to do, which is clear the harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings disastrous results. Then Damaya also thinks that adult Origenes fear nothing, not the stills or themselves. They don't even fear old man Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, of course, Cyanite discovers that her life is nothing but fear of guardians, of her children being used horribly, of being discovered as an Origene and hiding later on. And so things like that that just stuck out that, you know, we all have these ideas of what it's like in the real world or what it's going to be like when I'm grown up. And then you get there and you discover, no, nothing's at all the way I pictured it would be.
Right.
Let's see. I had some And you stop me if there's anything that you want to interject.
No, I often say, I can't remember where I saw it. I think it was on a card or something that maybe I got it for somebody years ago. Because I remember being in school and thinking, man, you know, when I get out of school and I go to college, you know, then everything will be better. And then I went to college, and I mean, college was a fun experience and everything, but then you're in college and you're like, I just want to be, you know, out and working in the real world. And so I found this card at some point, and I now often write it in like graduation cards and stuff. I'll say, you know, college prepares you for the real world, which also sucks.
Well, and like when you're a kid, you think, I'll know everything. I'll know how to handle.
Right.
Everything when I get to be an adult. And then you get to be an adult and you discover our parents were just flying by the seat of of their pants.
Yeah.
You know, they're figuring it out.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And it hopefully makes you a little less judgmental towards the older generation when you realize, you know what? Yeah. They were figuring it out just like I'm trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're a teen, especially, you're like, oh, those adults, they're just living in the past. They don't understand what it's like to be now. And then you get to be an adult and it's like, no, they really do understand. And boy, I feel bad for having misjudged them.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's see. So one of the things that I think really sticks out from this book, just in all the different characters, is humanity in some characters, or the lack thereof.
Yes.
So you've got Jija, which is Essen's husband, and you don't meet him at all through the whole book, but he is a monster.
Yes.
It introduces him as an ordinary man, well respected in his community, and then on page 10, this was the most shocking moment to me of the whole book, even more than the node maintainer, because you kind of, with the node maintainer, you had a build up, a sense of something's wrong as we're getting closer to this scene. Mm-hmm. But with Jija, you have Essen thinking to herself about, you know, her living room here, and she liked nursing her son Uche here. She thinks he was conceived here. His father has beaten him to death here. And just the cold brutality of that thought, that a father could beat his not even fully 3-year-old son to death.
Yeah.
And it talked a little bit about that, about the son before that, and how he was just a bright, happy little boy, had all of the qualities that makes parents love their children, you know, just a little darling child.
Yeah.
And his father beat him to death. That I cried.
Yeah, no,
at that point, and I.
It's a gut punch.
Yeah, let's see, and then the guardians are really monsters too. I mean, their cold brutality towards children. When Shafa is slowly breaking Damaya's fingers, on her hand, just to make his point of, can you control yourself? And then you find out later that he had a knife held to her side too, just in case she was going to try and stop him.
Right.
And the way Shafa treats Damaya makes me think of the Wheel of Time series. I don't know if you've read that at all.
No, I haven't.
But they have these, again, it's people with magical powers. And in one part of the world, you know, these women are revered and respected, but in another part of the world, any woman who is found with these magical powers has a collar with a leash attached to it put on, and she instantly ceases to be a person. She becomes property, and so that's the soul dom is the master, the mistress, and the demani is the property now, basically a dog that. You know, if you perform well, then I'll comb your hair and give you treats, but I still reserve the right to get angry at you.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm in a bad mood, and kick you around the house because, you know, things are just not going my way. Mm-hmm. And they no longer have any rights. I think the guardian origin relationship is perfectly paralleled by that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of almost like Demaya has Stockholm syndrome with Shafa too.
Right.
Like on page 329, it says Shafa loves her in his tender and terrifying way. And she
right.
he still ends up being the only one that she trusts.
Yeah, there's definitely some of the guardians that are, you know, that gleefully will kill an Origine.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like they're sociopaths. Where Shafa
yeah.
I think we're given to understand that he's a little mm-hmm. different.
But, well, you think so. And then at the very end, one guardian rips apart Inon
mm-hmm.
Just with his bare hands. And Shafa smiles at him. Like, they both smile at each other, kind of like, I understand the feeling of euphoria that you're getting right now.
Yeah.
And it's – so it really – it dehumanizes Shafa in that moment a lot, that you've been thinking, well, he's not as far gone. He's still better than the rest.
Right.
And then you realize, no, he's no different from the rest of them. And he was willing to take Corundum and he was going to make him into a node maintainer.
Right.
You know? So he's no better, but then you've got the monsters like Hoa that try so hard to seem normal and seem human so that he won't cause alarm to Essen
mm-hmm.
and he's trying to protect her. I mean, speaking of Essen, she has her monstrous moments too.
Yes.
You know, she destroys Tiramo because she gets filled with rage.
Mm-hmm.
She blames the whole community for the death of her son. To some extent, I mean, she's right. It is the mindset that everybody has, but still, they still shouldn't die for that, you know? And I don't know. I think Essen and Cyanite, you know, the person that they are, they're an interesting blend of monster and human, because mm-hmm. like, they've got their moments where they regret what they've done. You know, Cyanite sees how she has accidentally destroyed, and it was an accident, but she destroyed the coastal harbor of Alia.
Right.
And she sees that, you know, because of me, they dared to dream of a future. No one deserves to die for that. And so she tries to calm down the volcano and do what she can to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little bit later, she ends up destroying two ships full of innocent people that her pirate ship raided.
Right.
And, you know, to help keep her secret safe. Mm-hmm. And so it's an interesting thought of, like, did her circumstances shape her into a monster? Or was she, you know, what did she already have that inside her?
Right.
It makes you think.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you could definitely make an argument that her whole the path that she was on with the fulcrum and everything just and the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of
it's a hard world.
It's a hard world, yeah. And so that reaction is kind of understandable. And as a parent too, you can go, well, she's also protecting her son, but you know, at the cost of a bunch of lives, it's a lot to pay.
Right, I know, and those are things that moral quandaries. That don't have an easy answer. Like
yeah.
you want to protect your family, but then, you know, where's the line? How far will you go?
Yeah.
And at what point does it make you, it stop you from being a hero protecting your family to, you know, a monster?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll be interested to see kind of where it goes in the future books. Cause I imagine that we're still going to have our Essen as our point of view character, but
yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, and I really hope that we're going to have Hoa sticking around, too.
Yeah.
Let's see. I had a few more notes. It talks a little bit about civilization. You've got the civilized world of Eumenes, the kind of the capital city. Mm-hmm. It uses people who have been trained to think of themselves as nothing but tools. But then you've got Bart and, you know, that's where all the rich people hang out. But then you've got the barbaric Miov pirates where Origines are welcomed
right.
and celebrated as humans. And it's because of them that we live, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there's an interesting thought that Demaya has on page 75 or maybe it's Cyanite, that she thinks this is what it means to be civilized, doing what her betters say she should for the ostensible good of all.
Right.
Which is true. We should do... usually our betters are there for a reason. They know better than we do, and we do need to try and work for the good of all. But she is not allowed to be and do what she wants,
right,
is the problem in Eumenes. Whereas in Meoff, she is allowed. What'd you think about the use of the caste system?
Oh, the use names?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fascinating. Where you were, I mean, some of it is horrifying, right? The idea that someone is going to be labeled a breeder and, you know, they're only good for producing
children.
That's
their station in life. Yeah.
But then there's strongbacks, and I can't remember all of them, right? Leadership.
Let's see, resistant and innovators. I think that's all of them.
Yeah. And I kind of go, well, just because you name someone leadership, does that make them good leadership material?
No. Nope.
Yeah.
Well, and I was trying to figure out, like, it seemed as if some of it was dependent on where you were born to, who you were born to.
Yeah.
And then other things, it was kind of dependent on just what you looked like.
Yes.
So if you ended up kind of looking really nice, then you might look like you might end up as a breeder. If you ended up developing a strong body, then you might end up as a strong back. Or if you have a smart and intelligent mind, then you might be an innovator. So it seems like a little bit better than like, say, India's caste system, where you are allowed a little bit of who you are as a person to come into where your station in life becomes, and not just you're born into it and tough luck, that's it. But it is still interesting, because then, you know, a lot of the times you can't get out of that. That's your station in life. You're never going to rise higher.
Yep.
Yeah, so I think just a few last notes here.
Sure.
That was one of the things I think about the quality of life that the book kind of very quietly talks about is through the caste system. Then we talked about the breeding that Cyanite and Alabaster have to take part in. On page 73, Cyanite is thinking, she wonders why a part of her is trying to find value in degradation.
Right.
She's thinking, well, at least I was paired up with a 10-ring origin instead of someone lower. You know, she's trying to justify it. She thinks of how she's not really a person, but she still tries all throughout the book to be valued as one.
Yeah.
And I think it's really a shame, because for origins, the carrot's always out of reach. You know, they're always going to strive to be accepted and respected. But at least there on the mainland, they're only ever going to be feared and hated and seen as less than human. And there's a terrific end of chapter quote on page 76 that says, "Tell them they can be great someday like us. Tell them they belong among us no matter how we treat them. Tell them they must earn the respect which everyone else receives by default. There's a standard for acceptance, and that standard is simply perfection. Kill those who scoff at these contradictions, and tell the rest that the dead deserved annihilation for their weakness and doubt. Then they'll break themselves trying for what they'll never achieve."
Yeah. It kind of makes you understand Alabaster's decision, right? That this all has to go.
You know, it does. And it's a monstrous thing that he does. Mm-hmm. And yet, I mean, how many revolutions have started with... we've got to get rid of the old, clear it away completely in order to, you know, have any kind of good change come about.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of move into final thoughts.
Okay.
For me, I feel like, you know, this is a book that gives you a lot of things to think about, a lot to chew on, even though it's dark and somber and dreadful in places. It is beautifully written. I found it a very compelling read. Yeah, I'm looking forward to checking out where the rest of the story goes.
Yeah, I did think one thing that was interesting was there's not really any religion or deities that are mentioned.
Sure.
Or a belief in something greater. I think the closest you get is Father Earth.
Yes.
And it, I mean, humanity is seems to be mostly atheistic. And if they think of Earth as a deity, then it's as a vengeful one. Right. It should be feared. So that's kind of interesting too, because, you know, it's in times of darkness that, faith in something greater, faith in God and in a hope of something better that propels people to continue on. And yet these people don't really seem to have that. So that was kind of an interesting thought.
Yeah.
And, I think one last thing was, did you pick up that, I guess, the moon doesn't exist in this world?
I was curious about that because it's only mentioned at the very end of the book.
Well, there's a point where Cyanite is out on the ships with the pirates. They're going to go on their raiding parties stuff. And she's looking up at the stars and seeing planets out there and stuff. But there's no mention of the moon. And it could have just been a moonless night, but they're out there for a bunch of nights.
Yeah.
And so if there was a moon, she would have noticed it. And so, so that's interesting to consider how that would affect, Earth's tides and stuff.
I'll be on the lookout for that in the future books, or if I reread this one.
I wonder if they're if that's going to be a big plot point. Something happened to the moon, and so that was how Earth ended up being so messed up.
Yeah, cool. Well, let's go ahead and sum up. Where can people find you?
Okay, well, tto.kozer.us is the URL for the podcast that I co-host, 10 to 1. And you can email me at melissajkozer@gmail.com if you just want to talk about this book or any other books, or you can find me on Goodreads. And I'm on there just with my regular name, Melissa Kozer.
Nice. Well, I really want to thank you for doing this. I know that there were some challenges in getting everything scheduled and working around my schedule and then yours. So I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, it's been fun. This is actually the closest I've done to a book report since like high school. But it was really interesting, like, because it did make me dig down into why do people like this book so much. Mm-hmm. And it made me appreciate something that I might not have otherwise appreciated. And I definitely think I will check out the second and third books. I think this is a book that if you don't like the first time through, you should give it a second chance. Because I liked it better the second time around.
All right. Well, again, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. And say hi to Brian for me.
I will.
All right.
Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that episode with Melissa. I will put all the links to 10 to 1 in the show notes and highly encourage you to check that out. I will, of course, need somebody to cover the other books in this series. So if you're out there and you want to come on, go ahead and shoot me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or go up to hugospodcast.com and fill out the contact form. I also want to remind you, I do have a Patreon, patreon.com/hugospodcast, where if you want to donate and help defray some of the costs of putting the podcast on, you can do that. All right, that'll do it for this time. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.